From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Thursday, National Rifle Association boss Wayne LaPierre looked back at the past week and a half of activism following yet another devastating school shooting and defaulted to accusation mode.
As usual, the opportunist wasted not one second to exploit tragedy for political gain. Saul Alinsky would have been proud. The breakback speed of calls for more gun control laws and the breathless national media eager to smear the NRA.
Meanwhile, outside the Florida Capitol building in Tallahassee, and even in the offices of some state legislators, the survivors of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School carried on what they describe as a nonpartisan, long-due movement called Hashtag Never Again. The students, some of whom traveled to Tallahassee just hours after burying their friends, had an audacious idea to make the Parkland school shooting the last school shooting. According to Emily Witt, writer and reporter for The New Yorker, the conviction to achieve that took hold within hours of the massacre.
The initial conversations were on social media. Students in group chats shared their feelings, and then the night after the shooting, some students gathered together at the house of one of their friends, started a Facebook page that they called Never Again. And the media was everywhere. They were talking to tons of students, and they all decided to gather together under the name of this movement, Never Again.
They've chosen their battles. They've avoided an assault on the Second Amendment, or even just on Republicans in general, who are the most vocal guardians of the Second Amendment. How quickly did their tactics, their strategy, and their agenda coalesce?
I would say really within 48 hours, they had decided that they wanted to send a nonpartisan message. Some of them are advocating for a ban for the AR-15, but certainly not all of them. And the first step that they would like to make is simply more stringent background checks and what they call common sense gun law reform. Their sense of urgency really comes from wanting to stop this and not from taking a side. A lot of them are not even old enough to vote. And at the meetings in Tallahassee, there were kids that identified as Republicans, kids that identified as Democrats, and kids that said they had no party affiliation. They were just there because they want to stop gun violence.
You know, I don't want to necessarily identify him as the leader of this student movement in Parkland, but Patient Zero sort of is a kid named Cameron Caskey. Was he the first to seek fellow travelers for an organized movement?
He has a lot of energy. When he was little, or he probably got everybody organized on the playground. And he'd written a post on Facebook that had gotten the attention of the media, so he had started giving interviews with the national news media pretty quickly. So he was already out there. And his living room, I think, is where they've been having their planning sessions so far.
And he is the author of the slogan, Hashtag Never Again.
That's right. He said he came up with it while sitting on the toilet in his Ghostbuster pajamas, and he made it very clear that we could all quote him on that.
That's pretty charming, but does that little anecdote undercut their seriousness or actually support the notion that it's the real organic deal?
They're really upfront that they're still just kids and that that's part of the reason this shouldn't have happened to them. They shouldn't have had to cower in closets while their friends were getting shot. They're kids. They're really open about that.
Cameron Caskey, in his Ghostbuster pajamas, was also the one who changed the tune originally from a broadside against Republicans and their support for the NRA and against gun control to opening the discussion beyond standard political boundaries. How does a 17-year-old have the wherewithal to be so politically thoughtful?
These students are from one of the best public high schools in Florida, And in the midst of this tragedy, I think it's important to remember what a great American public high school can look like, how multicultural it is, how politically aware the students are. These are students that have grown up thinking about this issue. One other student leader, Jacqueline Corin, who's the junior class president, she wrote a 50-page paper on gun control for her AP composition and rhetoric class just a couple months ago. This is not an exceptional event out in the world to them. This is something they've grown up hearing about and thinking about and knowing that it could possibly happen to them.
You know, when I watch adult reporters at press conferences with the president and his spokespeople, I'm sometimes disgusted when respect crosses the line into deference, into undue deference based on the circumstances. This did not seem to be the case with these kids facing Marco Rubio and other politicians. They said what they meant, and they meant what they said.
Here is to move forward.
Wait, so hold on.
And
so right now, in the name of 17 people, you cannot ask the NRA to keep their money out of your campaign?
I think in the name of 17 people, I can pledge to you that I will support any law that will prevent a killer like this.
No, but I'm talking NRA money.
No, because...
Matter of fact, I bet we can get people in here to give you exactly as much money as the NRA would have.
But it's not... And you're right.
A group of 100 students came to Tallahassee to speak with state legislators. And I sat in on some of those meetings, and the students were very respectful. They chose their battles. They weren't going to sit there and wave their cell phones and record video and yell at anybody. They had very measured and thoughtful conversations with the very few lawmakers in Florida who were willing to meet with them.
All this in the midst of burying friends, trying to take care of their own mental health, preparing for the resumption of the school year. Being a junior in high school is not a cakewalk under the best of circumstances. There is a lot of pressure. How in the world do you suppose they are coping with this extraordinary ordeal?
Well, the students I spoke with said, especially the more activist students, said this is their way of grieving. A lot of these kids are extroverts. A few of them are in drama club, politics club, student government. They're the kind of kids that like to be out there and doing things. And for them, the grieving process has been about speaking their mind and trying to change something. They need to act because they feel a sense of urgency that sitting at home and crying would not make better. What these students believe that I think the rest of us have become too complacent or too cynical to believe is that this really could be the last mass shooting in a school in America. And their idealism is reminding a lot of us what we've lost in settling for the reality that we have. And that's been moving people all over the country.
Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emily Witt is a writer and reporter. Her article in The New Yorker is titled, How the Survivors of Parkland Began the Never Again Movement. For a brief time this week, the top trending item on YouTube was a video claiming that Parkland student David Hogg was not actually a student, but a crisis actor. And the attack did not actually happen, but was a hoax to bolster support for gun regulation. Theories about government-led false flag attacks go back a long time. Think, for example, of 9/11 truthers. But the idea that a national tragedy has been completely invented with actors pretending to be victims is a relatively new kind of cruelty. This week, Jason Kebler of Motherboard set out to find the origins of the term crisis actor and found that it first emerged in 2012, just after the Sandy Hook massacre.
So this originated on some WordPress blogs, actually. And the original place I saw it was on a post that talked about a, quote, triangulation between Sandy Hook, the Aurora shooting, and Hurricane Sandy. It also talked about time stream manipulation and like government holograms and things of this nature. So it's really far out there stuff.
Now, obviously, this is totally Looney Tunes, but it was picked up by someone who was actually at least nominally credentialed, that seemed to have some standing. Who was that?
Right. So his name is James Tracy. He's a former communications professor at Florida Atlantic University, and he runs this blog called the Memory Hole Blog. He ran these series of posts called Investigating Sandy Hook. At first, he was just talking about inconsistencies between the official narrative and things that people were saying in interviews. But by post 3 or 4, he had fully picked up this idea that these people weren't real.
For example, the interviews with bystanders, parents and children, seem somewhat stilted.
He suggested that some of them were, quote, itinerant crisis actors. And that's actually a phrase that comes from this theater acting troupe called Vision Box, this theater in Colorado that created this service because there were so many shootings in the United States for something called, quote, crisis acting. And they said that our trained actors will pretend to be taking part in a mall shooting so that first responders, paramedics, firefighters can practice because these sorts of services were needed in so many places.
Yeah, now this category of acting, it's been around for a long time, but it was this one company that branded their version of this crisis actors.
Yeah, so in the emergency response industry, the term that they use is role players, someone who might pretend to have a heart attack or might pretend to have gotten shot. They often put them in makeup. They, you know, give them cue cards that list their symptoms so that paramedics can practice sort of their scripts and what they need to say in a real emergency. But yes, Vision Box was the first that I could find who branded this as crisis acting.
This Professor Tracy, who has since lost his job at Florida Atlantic, I can see how he would do a blog post on it and so forth. What's the ecosystem that turns that into a widely known term of art?
James Tracy makes these posts, and they were later picked up by InfoWars, which is Alex Jones's conspiracy theory site.
Now, again, in the last month and a half, I have not come out and said that this was clearly a staged event. Unfortunately, evidence is beginning to come out that points more and more in that direction.
It starts to gain steam on the right. And then there was a reporter for the Florida Sun Sentinel who said, hey, maybe someone who's teaching the next generation shouldn't be espousing these views. So he wrote a newspaper article about it, and it soon became sort of like a national controversy. It was very quickly talked about on CNN with Anderson Cooper.
I mean, I don't even know how that would work, that the news media would somehow meet with government officials and then somehow hire crisis actors who I've never even heard of.
And, you know, it was this big controversy for a little while, and then it went away. But it's come back during the Bataclan shooting, the Orlando nightclub shooting, and all these other mass tragedies that we've seen. And it's actually been retrofitted into previous shootings where no one had actually suggested crisis actors were there in the first place. No one was suggesting, for instance, that crisis actors were at the Aurora Theater shooting, which happened before Sandy Hook. But after this conspiracy theory gained steam, people went back and said that that was fake as well.
There was a girl, a crisis actor, in Aurora, Colorado. She showed up at the Boston Marathon bombing, and she also showed up at Sandy Hook.
Now, the thing about this guy, Tracy, no matter how unhinged his theory, is that he was a professor. And this, in and of itself, seemed to give him credibility.
I don't actually believe in all these theories that are circulating about Sandy Hook, but we're going to talk to the professor before the bottom of the hour.
That was from a guy named Paul Joseph Watson, who was subbing for Alex Jones on InfoWars. Do you think if James Tracy had not been a professor but an actuary that we would be even having this conversation?
I don't think we would. I think that's a really good point. All of those original stories focused on the fact that, you know, a university professor was espousing these views. People were saying, this is so horrible, which then spreads the idea further, and eventually it became national news. This was circulating on the fringes even further out than Tracy, and no one was talking about it then. So it very well may have died had he not posted about it.
On the subject of paying attention to something that is in and of itself probably not worthy of attention, Anderson Cooper created a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Now, there are always conspiracy theorists lurking online who come up with some horrifically outrageous claims. And normally, we would not dignify these kind of claims with our airtime. These claims are obviously sickening to many in Newtown who've spent the...
It reminds me of the Mark Twain line that it takes two people to really hurt you to the quick, an enemy to slander you, and a friend to get the news back to you. Are the media culpable for taking something marginal and turning it into a thing by the very act of reporting on it?
I think there's something to that, and I think it's a very difficult question to know for sure. But we do often think about, you know, did we do more harm than good in the 2016 election cycle by, you know, reporting on these conspiracy theories that once repeated enough, they seem a little bit more plausible and take something that's very fringe and make it a little bit more mainstream. There's also something to be said for tracing these conspiracy theories back to their original source, because in this instance, you know, this was mentioned alongside holograms and time stream manipulation and things that are just patently absurd. And I think, you know, actually looking at where it originates and demystifying it to a certain degree can be valuable.
Jason, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Jason Kebler is editor-in-chief of Motherboard. He recently wrote Where the Crisis Actor Conspiracy Theory Comes From.
Coming up, when young people take to the streets, how do the grown-ups usually respond? We take a look back and ahead.
The 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was literally driven by young people themselves. And so from that sentiment alone, we had the most radical social change ever led by young people in the United States. And that's your generation, Brooke. Thank you for that.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Many pundits, politicians, many people seem stunned by the passion and eloquence of the Parkland kids. The word kid being a label, it seems they wouldn't mind. Because being a kid can be useful. For them, sure. But even more useful to us. Alvin Toffler, the author of Future Shock, once wrote that the secret message communicated to most young people today by the society around them is that they are not needed. That the society will run itself quite nicely until they, at some distant point in the future, will take over the reins. Yet the fact is that society is not running itself nicely, because the rest of us need all the energy, brains, imagination, and talent that young people can bring to bear down on our difficulties. For society to attempt to solve its desperate problems without the full participation of even very young people is imbecile. And so here it seems we are, but not for the first time. Adam Fletcher, co-founder of the Free Child Project, says that the students of Parkland are only the most recent case of children in the lead.
In 1904, we had Mother Jones, this wild, powerful, strong suffragette who led the first march that involved child activists that we know of from Pennsylvania all the way to D.C. to really make a point, hey, these kids in these mines, these kids in these factories are working too hard. Child activists led a movement that ended up having child labor banned in the United States.
But as you've often noted yourself, it's a question of who is in front. Was it the kids or was it Mother Jones?
We call them youth-adult partnerships. She might have stood in front, but she had those kids, 70,000 young people, not as the subjects of her work, not just as the token pieces, but she brought them along as partners.
So I guess the next big time would be the civil rights era, the Children's Crusade. Again, kids were employed in sending that message, but did they drive it?
Dr. King and the civil rights leaders of that time were very intentional about not wanting child activists to be standing out front during those marches, if only because of the violent, hate-filled nature of the white supremacists of that time. But at the same time that that was happening, we had youth councils across the nation that were already doing local civil rights campaigns. They might not have been in Birmingham facing the dogs immediately, but they were in Omaha, Nebraska, fighting against segregation in pools and entertainment places. They were in Chicago, Seattle, LA. They were all across the nation. We have to remember that what happened in Greensboro, these young people basically led and began this sit-in movement across the country by staying at the lunch counter after they were rejected because they were African Americans. In Birmingham, Bull Connor sicked the dogs on children and youth who were marching with Dr. Mm-hmm. King. But at that point in the movement, Dr. King knew that the visual aspect of young people being faced with fire hoses and dogs would shake the nation. And he called it right, because it certainly did.
You know, in the course of my research for this interview, I came across the word ephebophobia. It was originally defined as fear of teenagers, and later as inaccurate, exaggerated, and sensational characterizations of young people. How much do you think youth movements have been impeded by the prejudices and preconceptions of adults?
Well, Brooke, let's go back just a little bit and actually address that question of where does ephebiphobia show up. You have fewer adults than ever before voting to support school levies. You have more adults than ever before voting to support mass incarceration, the prison school pipeline, and the disproportionate lockup of young people of color. You have more adults than ever before showing less and less interest in the succeeding generations than ever before. And Brooke, the only logical reason behind that, and it's not even logical, is this sense of cynicism and disregard for the generation, an absence of concern and well-being for the future. And it's not necessarily that we have an authentic and real reason to be scared of youth. It's that we don't want to see the transfer of power from one generation to the next.
I wonder how effective these youth movements can really be. I mean, I well remember protesting the Vietnam War when I was 13. But later, I learned that actually public opinion didn't track with youth protests, but with the mounting number of American deaths on the battlefield. So it seemed like what we did didn't really matter at all.
We know that it was youth activism that brought attention to the mounting number of deaths on the battlefield. And so even if we don't see that long-term outcome like you're alluding to, we still see a deep impact that goes beyond the immediate and gets more towards let's change the structures, let's change the cultures that pervade this country and make it a better place for everybody to be.
Why couldn't the boomers keep it up?
So what happened in the 1970s was that all these folks who were so passionate and so empowered with making a difference in the world, they faced the forces of economics, they faced the forces of culture, and they went out to start making money.
Well, that sounds like they didn't mean it to begin with.
Well, it doesn't mean that they were shallow or weak. It means that they were faced with the reality of adult life.
Ah.
The way that it works is if you want a family, if you want a house, you got to go to work for it.
Let's talk about Generation X. I mean, every generation gets smeared and slagged by the one it's replacing, but the Xers got it bad, and I take it you're an Xer.
In the 80s and 90s, we were portrayed as being lazy, apathetic. There were stories that hypersensationalized crime, that made youth drug use seem rampant, that made youth sex seem just terrible, and really painted Generation X to be another lost generation in America. The fact of the matter is, though, Brooke, we learned how to stand up for social change in ways that weren't as obvious as the 1970s and 60s. We saw their picket signs, and we saw their protests, and we saw their culture, their clothing, their hair, their news, and instead we created our own. We now know enough to teach and coach young people how to watch out for the media that portrayed us as being so bad, how to work against politicians that would suppress, repress, and otherwise deny the power and ability of youth today. Generation X is actually acting as the shepherds for young people who are coming into all this. We saw it in Black Lives Matter. We saw it in previous social movements in the last 20 years, and we're going to continue seeing it until I'm old, at least, because I know that I'm sticking with it.
So how about the millennials, another profoundly maligned generation? Can they get past the inferiority complex the media have worked so hard to propagate? We've put together a little montage.
We're talking about millennials, those 20-somethings who are always texting and tweeting. They move from job to job and seem to be more laid back about life and seem to be very entitled.
Cereal sales could be in jeopardy because millennials don't like to wash dishes. They're just too lazy.
I'm going to take a
Hold
picture
on.
Of myself.
I got to check
on.
My
yeah.
Facebook
I'm Post it. Hold on.
I'm going
Twitter
to the bathroom. Something.
Let me get my iPhone. Hold
I can't
on.
Think.
Look at me. Look at me. Look at me.
So, luckily for us, millennials today, one of the tools in their toolbox is that they have media criticism on the forefront of their brain. They were brought into the news stream not by Dan Rather and not by Walter Cronkite, but instead by Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. They were brought into this perspective of the world that truth is actually a rather arbitrary thing at times. And their abilities as critical thinkers are off the charts. They didn't just have the technology. They were born into it and learned how to use it from their inception. So I actually have more hope for millennials in the way that they see the world than I've ever had for my own. And I have a lot of hope for Gen X. I even held out a little bit of hope for your generation, Brooke. The young people who become the young tech entrepreneurs and are really working to change the world with their money have begun raising their children in these ways that say, hey, you are powerful, capable from the time that you are kids. And all those news media clips that you just played, I'm not even sure if a millennial heard them because the media that they were played on might be completely irrelevant to them.
So what about today's generation, the high school kids walking out of school, planning marches, taking on the political establishment so directly?
You know, we used to say that youth are the future. I'm seeing today's generation being that future more than ever before.
But do you really believe the arc of history bends towards justice?
Dr. King taught us that there is constant momentum. There's constant movement to social change. Every young person today is standing on the shoulders of the giants who came before them, and they're tied together with every other thing that's ever come before. Where those young people who marched with Mother Jones in 1904 were actually standing on the front lines in St. Louis and Ferguson against the police and against the National Guard and standing with Black Lives Matter. We know that the people from the 60s and 50s who were in the civil rights movement and the social movements of the 60s and 70s, we know that they're standing with the movement today and demanding change for gun legislation.
And what if this current wave of protest ultimately has no real impact?
This current wave of protest has already had real impact on the hearts and minds of young people towards the way that our government works, the influence of economics and politics, and the real ability of people to individually as well as collectively take action to make social change happen. That's just in the last week. Imagine what 3 months of this activism is going to look like. Imagine what a year of this activism is going to look like. And suddenly, Brooke, we begin to see that there's a whole new palette that we're painting from because we're going to have more adults coming out of the woodwork to support these young people. And we're going to have more communities that really take ownership of this because they are going to begin to see youth are the future once more.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Adam Fletcher is the founder of the Free Child Project, which advises and advocates for young people engaged in social change around the world.
Coming up in the middle of Black History Month, a movie with a black cast, an African setting, and utopian ideas makes history.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. February is Black History Month, which explains the latest national celebration of Frederick Douglass, George Washington Carver, Harriet Tubman, and Martin Luther King Jr. And not a whole lot else. The commemoration, proclaimed by Gerald Ford in 1976 as an outgrowth of Harvard educator Carter G. Woodson's 1926 initiative Negro History Week, has expanded the scope of the original by a factor of four, but also perhaps shrunk.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Knit. Historian John William Templeton says the reductiveness, the pomp and iconography minus actual history, has contaminated the grandeur with elements of farce. And writing in The New Yorker, social critic Doreen St. Felix says that the focus on the handful of familiar faces obliterates the view of Black history writ large.
Black History Month, having been something that was established a little over 40 years ago, we've seen that it's very quickly taken on this character where we pay lip service to very recognizable and often strictly political Black figures. There's not really an effort to make anything more than shallow inquiries into what we might call the breadth of Black American history.
The George Washington Carverization of Black history.
Exactly.
I refer, of course, to the only African-American scientist who ever lived, who famously came up with 133 uses for the peanut, which is not nothing, but perhaps maybe overemphasized.
It's, of course, very significant that George Washington Carver was a scientist and a food anthropologist when he was, and he made many advancements into the way that the American diet actually exists today. He was one of the first people who figured out recipes for pressing nuts into milk, and we're in that fever right now. You know, everybody's like trying to find another kind of milk alternative, and this was someone who anticipated that nearly a century ago. But what happens is when students are taught that someone like George Washington Carver is a saint of Black history, there's a strange political frame that emerges. Someone like Carver is overemphasized because he doesn't seem dangerous. And that's why his work with the peanut is always emphasized. George Washington Carver was actually someone who advocated for Black farmers in the South. But that's not something that you hear because, of course, then a suite of questions ensue. Why were these Americans poor? And then you start talking about Jim Crow, and that's not something that is really encouraged in our general conversations.
On the other hand, as it was originally conceived, at least by Gerald Ford, I suppose, to inspire pride and understanding of shared Black history and distinct Black history in the United States, it's not entirely useless. Has it met its principal goal?
It is important, and it does affect students of all races to learn that there have been great Black American figures. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to remain vigilant about how certain narratives are being flattened and being commercialized often. For anyone who was watching the Super Bowl, you might have seen that commercial.
The Dodge Ram truck commercial featuring Martin Luther King Jr.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant.
for those of us who feel very sensitive to the commercialization of his legacy, it's heartbreaking. Watching a game that has brutalized so many men, and many of those men being Black, and then again seeing a commercial that completely decontextualizes the agenda of a figure like Martin Luther King Jr. His socialism is something that is like just not mentioned at all during this month, or not mentioned at all during Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which happens the month before. So you're always in this really tenuous spot when you recognize that whatever we get is good, right? Because we get so little, but at the same time, we always want to be pushing for more and for higher quality education.
There are those, and I am right now thinking of Morgan Freeman, the actor, who think that any effort to discriminate between the American Black experience and American history altogether is itself a mistake. Here he is in a conversation with the late Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes.
Black History Month, you find
ridiculous.
Why?
You're going to relegate my history to a month?
Oh, come on.
What do you do with yours? Which month is White History Month? Come on, tell me.
I'm Jewish.
Okay, which month is Jewish History Month?
There isn't one.
Oh, why not?
Yeah.
You want one?
No.
I don't either.
So this interview has definitely entered the lore in terms of cantankerous old Black people and their opinions. Obviously, what Freeman is saying, it has a grain of truth. Black history is not something that can be relegated to a month.
What he's describing is segregated history.
And that's how he sees it. Of course, there are people like myself who find problems with Black History Month, but don't necessarily see it as like a segregationist exercise. It originated in the work of Carter G. Woodson, who was the second Black person to receive a doctorate from Harvard after, of course, the father of Black history, Du Bois. When he and his colleagues were building journals of African American history, when they were establishing associations, what they were discussing was that a subjugated people needs to have its history in order to assert its identity within the present. And that's, I think, a very radical political notion that has proceeded from the way that we think of Black History Month.
Whether it's George Washington and the cherry tree, or Lincoln freeing the slaves, or ask not what your country can do for you, we don't typically consume any part of our history in the most sophisticated and multidimensional form. Is there something peculiar about Black History Month that makes it more trivialized than the rest of the country's history?
I think absolutely. And that is, to be crude, it is the forces of racism and how they have contributed to the way historiography works in America. So one of the clearest examples I actually experienced this year in terms of how Black history is like purposefully shaped would be the case of Recy Taylor. Oprah mentioned her during the Golden Globes Award speech.
When she was abducted by 6 armed white men, raped and left blindfolded by the side of the road, coming home from church. They threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone. But her story was reported to the NAACP, where a young worker by the name of Rosa Parks became the lead investigator on her case. And together, they sought justice.
And Rosa Parks is someone that we actually have a high familiarity with her social contributions, right? But this story didn't really fit with the kind of like iconic image of her deciding that she was not going to get off her seat in the bus. It's not something that we can fit into acceptable narratives or like etiquette of how we actually think civil rights happened.
Should, instead of George Washington Carver, we be seeing Recy Taylor? Should we be seeing Medgar Evers, Emmett Till, Malcolm X? Is the main problem here not what is presented, but what is not presented?
I think that's definitely a place to begin. But I think also something that needs to be emphasized is a sense of movements in Black history. Because we emphasize so much individual figures, we don't have a sense of the communities that they've actually come from.
Doreen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Doreen St. Felix is a staff writer for The New Yorker.
City Gang!
Over the past week, long-awaited images of a mythical kingdom on the big screen.
Wakanda forever!
The setting of Black Panther, Wakanda, can be found deep in the heart of Africa, blessed with seemingly unlimited access to vibranium, the hardest, most powerful metal on Earth.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
Textiles, shepherds, cool outfits.
All a front. Explorers have searched for it, called it El Dorado. They looked for it in South America. But it was in Africa the whole time.
Since it was first conceived by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby of Marvel Comics in the 1960s, Wakanda has been imagined and reimagined. Just last year, we saw comic book updates from authors Ta-Nehisi Coates and Roxane Gay that explored the greater Wakandan world, imagining the Black Panther universe with an eye toward modern social and political struggle. In Ryan Coogler's cinematic Black Panther, Wakanda's possession of vibranium leads to the central tension of the film. Share your wealth with the world and risk becoming a target to predators and pillagers and empire? Or keep the spoils of your natural bounty within your borders and turn your back on the suffering of refugees and the larger African diaspora? Can a country spread its good fortune without being forced into a struggle for its own survival? Johns Hopkins University professor Nathan Connolly says that in the world of Black Panther, Wakanda's survival is made possible in part thanks to its secrecy.
Wakanda is obscured by dense forests and later by a kind of elaborate hologram that allows it to remain hidden from satellites and foreign spies and the like. It's rich beyond imagining, is extraordinarily advanced. In fact, if you look at the original comic book from the mid-60s, what you actually see is a Wakandan using the equivalent of a cell phone with a Bluetooth headset. And so the Wakandans never have to extend beyond their borders to generate wealth. They never have to enslave any other populations. Not like England or France that had an elaborate plantation system in the Americas or any number of countries that colonized the physical continent of Africa. It's a counterpoint to what the actual history of modern wealth creation has been for industrialized countries. The point about the film, of course, is to say, what would it mean if there was a bottomless resource that you could use to basically solve the problem of racism and poverty for all Black people around the world?
In an interview with the New York Times, film director Ava DuVernay, who's about to come out with A Wrinkle in Time, said that Wakanda itself is a dream state, a place that's been in the hearts and minds and spirits of Black people since we were brought here in chains.
So you would have to really begin in the 15-teens with the first maroon communities. The first small number of African slaves ran off into the hills over Santo Domingo to escape the brutalities of slavery and colonization. And, you know, maroon communities are very much like Wakanda in function. They're meant to exist outside of the watchful eye of European powers, places of autonomy. In Dutch Suriname, in the United States, multiple centuries of dreaming about places of independence, feeding into what ultimately becomes the vision of Wakanda.
And you focused particularly on the connection between Black utopian thought and the founding of Haiti and tied that into Wakanda.
So Haiti is critical, but in that 1804, what you have is the first modern nation state established by Black people, a Black republic in a kind of European and Euro-American model. It is unthinkable that people would be able to remove themselves from the bondage of slavery, then establish a country, write a constitution, develop an economy. This is a dangerous, dangerous idea that the country of Haiti could be on America's doorstep and possibly encourage slave revolts.
Because of the uprising at the end of the 1700s, which gave rise ultimately to its independence.
Correct. It's Haiti as an idea that I think is largely what the film and what the comic book series was built upon. The other thing is, if you think about where Wakanda comes from, even in the minds of comic book creators like Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. It absolutely is part of a flowering of ideas about Black nationalism in the mid-1960s. So you have people who are returning to the history of the Haitian Revolution because they're looking at models for Black self-determination. So a very important book that was written in 1938 by a historian named C.L.R. James called Black Jacobins, and it was considered to be the dominant kind of take on the Haitian Revolution. It falls out of print within a decade of coming out, but it comes back into print in 1963 because American readers, and particularly civil rights activists, are looking for models of Black self-determination. The first comic book treatment of the Haitian Revolution is the same exact year that Black Panther is established in Marvel Comics. And of course, then later, the Black Panther Party, after the comic book already comes out, is established in Oakland, California. All this to say that you cannot disentangle the scholarship on the Haitian Revolution, the historical events and the imagining of the Haitian Revolution from what becomes seemingly an innocuous fictional treatment. And again, the concern and the question about what's the responsibility and the place of a Black nation in a larger world of oppressed people, that's a question that was raised from the inception of Haiti as a country in 1804.
What makes you so sure that these Jewish outsiders in the mid-last century, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, that they had really encountered this material and were referencing it?
So ideas about Black nationhood are everywhere in the mid-1960s. You don't have to place Stan Lee or Jack Kirby in a meeting with a kind of Back to Africa movement to understand that there's already going to be a very wide and broad set of discussions and conversations in the newspaper, in public meeting places, where the idea of Black autonomy is going to be front and center for them. And I'll also say, if you talk to Stan Lee about even the creation of other non-Black characters like the X-Men, he's drawing explicitly from the civil rights movement. So Professor X is meant to hearken to Martin Luther King. Malcolm X is represented through the character of Magneto. And it's yet another example of the politics of the 1960s being turned into the creative fodder for really iconic treatments in Marvel Comics pages.
And you wrote, "Dreams to Art to Life and Back Again." You were basically saying that you can't approach it until you dream it.
Yeah, I mean, the story about, you know, say the Haitian Revolution or Maroon communities or even the Civil Rights Movement, they begin with visions. They begin with imagination. They begin with the creative process, right? None of this is possible until you dream it. The power of a film like Black Panther and what people are really responding to is the fact that this is a vision that they have never seen before. It's suggesting that there is a way for an African nation to be the most advanced nation in the world, that it might well be possible to have advancement without environmental degradation.
When we talk about the utopianism of Wakanda, we have to concede that it's based on unlimited access to vibranium. So what can we learn from a utopian vision that's based on a made-up and impossible natural resource?
There are all kinds of utopian visions that are out there that are currently driving our politics. I mean, it's remarkable to think about, again, the free market as a utopian concept. If you just subject everyone in the world to the same free market principles, the magic of the market will give out everyone's, you know, goods and services in the measure that they need. And all of these things drive policy. And so it doesn't have to be a fantastical element like vibranium to be part of a utopian vision. When the film really does approach its most powerful moments, it's not about vibranium at all, but it's about the connection between people. What's the feasibility of creating an equitable relationship between the people who have been disempowered through slavery and colonization and the rest of the world?
I'm glad you said that, because I was looking at this article by Jim Geraghty at the National Review, who loved the film. But he said, "We know Wakanda can't exist. And it's not just because vibranium is fictional. Wakanda can't exist, not owing to any inherent flaw in Africans, but because of the inherent flaws of human beings. Every human society involves trade-offs. If you want more security, you're probably going to have less freedom from surveillance and fewer civil liberties. If you want to avoid the paralysis of division, you have to concentrate power. But absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Right.
In theory, you can avoid wealth disparity through socialism, but collective collectivism destroys the incentives to create, innovate, and work hard, he wrote, and a corrupt few inevitably rise to the top, creating new wealth disparities. People have to choose what values they prioritize in their nation.
It's a little bit of a conceit to say that, well, we really can't be realistic as we're the ones sitting on more of the resources and the affluence, right?
Mm-hmm.
To think through the problem of relations between white and black and brown populations around the world, the global South versus the North, all of that stuff is really front and center. And what happens with Wakanda, of course, is a kind of suspicion that this wealth is even possible because it's seen as being, quote unquote, a nation of farmers and herders, right? That stereotype is part of what the problem is, because believe it or not, when you see the president making a comment about people from Haiti or from Africa basically living in the pits of hell, part of that is actually about not understanding the real resource of places like Africa or Haiti, which are its people. I mean, vibranium, in so many respects, is actually a powerful metaphor for the untapped potential of Africa and its people. What kind of fantastic futures are possible if we really think about the resources of these populations that have been ignored and overlooked? They're already in our midst. We literally have vibranium living in our communities around this country that we have yet to take full advantage of by investing in it and allowing people to grow and be contributing members of society. Would we invest in that the way we might invest in a space age metal if given the opportunity?
Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University and co-host of the weekly podcast Backstory.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, and Leia Fetter. We had more help from John Hanrahan, Isaac Nappel, and Philip Yiannopoulos. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Terrence Bernardo. And our show was edited by Brooke.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.